This 13th talk in a series on the Gospel of John was presented by Ryan Carroll on June 26, 2022. Scripture readings precede the teaching. Questions follow the teaching.
The first reading today is from 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 1 and 2, and 6 through 14. And it came about when the Lord was about to take up Elijah by a whirlwind to heaven, that Elijah went to Elisha from Gilgal, and Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. Then Elijah said to him, "Please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan." And he said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. Now 50 men of the sons of the prophets went and stood opposite them at a distance, while the two of them stood by at the Jordan. Elijah took his mantle and folded it together and struck the waters, and they were divided here and there, so that the two of them crossed over on dry land. When they had crossed over, Elijah said to Elisha, "Ask what I shall do for you before I am taken from you." And Elisha said, "Please, let a double portion of your spirit be upon me." He said, "You have asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I am taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so." As they were going along and talking, behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire which separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind to heaven. Elisha saw it, and he cried out, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen." And he saw Elijah no more. And then he took hold of his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. He also took up the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and returned and stood by the bank of the Jordan. He took the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and struck the waters and said, "Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" And when he also had struck the waters, they were divided here and there, and Elisha crossed over.
I'm reading from Philippians 2, 1 through 11. "Therefore, if there is any encouragement in Christ, if any consolation of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and compassion, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility consider one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look for your own personal interest, but also for the interest of others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, as he already existed in the form of God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a bondservant and being born in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, death on a cross. For this reason also God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee will bow, of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father."
A poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. For all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things, and though the last lights off the black west went, O morning, at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with bright wings.
This is a reading from the Gospel of John, chapter 5, 1 through 20. After these things, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porticos. In these lay a multitude of those who were sick, blind, lame, and withered, waiting for the moving of the waters. For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the water. Whoever then first, after the stirring up of the water, stepped in, was made well from whatever disease with which he was afflicted. A man was there who had been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been a long time in that condition, he said to him, "Do you wish to get well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your pallet, and walk." Immediately the man became well and picked up his pallet and began to walk. Now it was the Sabbath on that day, so the Jews were saying to the man who was cured, "It is the Sabbath, and it is not permissible for you to carry your pallet." But he answered them, "He who made me well was the one who said to me, 'Pick up your pallet and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is this man who said to you, 'Pick up your pallet and walk'?" But the man who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had slipped away while there was a crowd in that place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "Behold, you have become well. Do not sin any more, so that nothing worse happens to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. For this reason, the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But he answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I myself am working." For this reason, therefore, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he not only was breaking the Sabbath, but also was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. Therefore Jesus answered and was saying to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself unless it is something he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, these things the Son also does in like manner. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all things that he himself is doing, and the Father will show him greater works than these, so that you will marvel."
Okay, John chapter 5. Here we go. There's a lot to say here, and I'm not going to take on the entirety of John chapter 5. We read up through verse 20. There is a lot there, and there's going to be some things that I'm going to really focus on and some things I'm not going to be able to get to, but especially just know that next time we get together, we will do the second half of John chapter 5. A lot of significant things that Jesus ends up saying about himself in the process. But here we are. Jesus has come back into Jerusalem for another feast, chapter 5, verse 1. And it's important to sort of contextualize this just in terms of John's narrative. Remember that Jesus has been to Jerusalem now, at least within the narrative, one time already. He was in Jerusalem in chapter 2 for the Passover. And if you remember when he was there, he said some incendiary things while standing in the temple. And so he plans to do so again. This is his thing. This is what Jesus does. He likes to provoke, and he's gonna definitely do a good job of provoking here. And when we get through with this whole story, we're going to ask ourselves the question, is this all, did he heal this guy just to like make a point and just to provoke things just so he could talk? And the answer, I think, is yes. I think the answer is yes. And we'll get there. We'll talk about that. But it's also important to notice that Jerusalem up to this point has been a place of sort of hostility. Okay. We first are introduced to Jerusalem and hostility in John chapter 1 when the Baptist is out in the wilderness baptizing. And lo and behold, Jews send a delegation of priests and Levites from Jerusalem to question John. What are you doing? Why are you doing what you're doing? Right? There's this sense of conflict kind of in the air. And then, of course, we have chapter 2 where Jesus goes into Jerusalem. He stands up in the temple and he clears the temple of the money changers and the animals. And he says, stop making my father's house a house of merchandise, calling the temple his father's house. And ultimately, as we talked about, sort of claiming authority over what happens there, right? And of course, the Jews who are there, the Pharisees, they push back. What gives you the right? What authority do you have here? And ultimately, there's more conflict there. And then we have that note by John at the end of that section where it says, and Jesus did many signs while he was in Jerusalem for the Passover, and many were believing in him, but Jesus was not believing in them because he knew what was in man, right? And so there's this sense of foreboding. And for any reader of John's gospel in the first century or whenever John's gospel began to circulate, it is very likely that they potentially are aware of and have read other of the gospel accounts, and they know what's going on in Jerusalem. Jerusalem's the place where Jesus is going to die, right? But in the course of John's gospel, John is sort of laying these seeds, like every time Jesus goes into Jerusalem, a new sort of problem occurs. Jesus opens his mouth and there's confrontation. And so here we are now in chapter 5. He's back, right? We don't know what feast it is. Some speculate that it's a Passover again. Others say, oh, it's this or that. It doesn't really matter in this case what the feast is. What matters more is what day it is, okay? And the day is the Sabbath, all right? Now, we don't find that out until after Jesus does the thing that he's not technically, you know, potentially supposed to do on the Sabbath. But yes, it is the Sabbath. Also, it's important to note that John has weaved in a few other notes for us about Jesus in Jerusalem. Remember, Jesus is baptizing people. John the Baptist gives his final witness. And then John the writer tells us that Jesus is leaving Judea because the Pharisees have heard that he's making more disciples than John. Okay, there's this air of conflict. There's this brewing of ill will between the Jewish leadership and Jesus. So Jesus goes back out of Judea at that point at the beginning of chapter 4, spends his couple days in Samaria, and then he goes into Galilee, finishes his trip north. And John tells us there towards the end of chapter 4 that Jesus went into Galilee and the Galileans received him. And John tells us that Jesus had testified that a prophet has no honor in his own country. And probably most likely when John is talking about Jesus's home country, he is referring to Judea, not to Galilee, but to Judea. And then, of course, John gives us another little thing at the very end of chapter 4, verse 54. After he heals the royal official's son, which we talked about last week, John mentions this is a second sign that Jesus has performed when he had come out of Judea into the Galilee. So the first sign was the wedding at Cana. He turns the water into wine. He was in Judea before that. He came to Cana. He does the miracle. Now he's come back out of Judea again, come into the Galilee, and he's performed this second sign. And so now Jesus is back in Jerusalem, this place where so far has just kind of been antagonistic, right? Okay. Also, before we kind of get into this, it's important to note John has chosen 7 signs, right? It tells us at the end of the gospel, I have selected these specific signs among all of the things that Jesus had done, and he uses hyperbole, all the things could fill up, you know, more books than the entire world could handle. But I've chosen these specific signs that you might believe that he is the Messiah, and that believing you might have life in his name. So now in John chapter 5, there's going to be the third of these seven signs. Okay, the first being the water into wine, the second being the healing of the royal official's son, and now we have the third. Remember that, again, John's calling these signs, not miracles, and it's important to sort of note that the signs need context. Doing miracles is not necessarily a sign of anything. It could be just a sign that you're a lucky dude, right? Or a lucky person. Like, the signs only become signs in the context of some kind of other information, right? And for the first sign, remember, the first sign was ultimately for his disciples. Very few people actually witnessed that first sign. And it was a sign to the disciples because they had been told through the testimony of John, this is the Lamb of God. This is the one I've been talking about. And they think, oh my gosh, yeah. And they go and they spend time with him, like, oh, could this be the Messiah? Could this be the Messiah? We think this is the Messiah. We think this is the guy that Moses wrote about. And then Jesus does the sign that confirms this belief, right? So, and then in the second instance, the royal official hears this sign. The question is, the royal official has heard the news about Jesus. He knows what Jesus is capable of. He knows potentially that Jesus is Messiah. And Jesus does this sign, and it confirms it for the royal official, and he and his family believe. So here we are, and Jesus has now a third sign. Without spelling it all out ahead of time, I want you to like be thinking as we're going through the story, noticing how this sign is sort of operating differently. There's some differences here, some real differences between what happens and how people respond to it. Okay? Ultimately, what we're going to be most interested in talking about is the statement that Jesus makes down in verse 17 when the rulers, the Jews, are persecuting Jesus for doing this work on the Sabbath. And Jesus says, my Father is working until now, and I myself am working. What does that mean? And of course, the Jews' response to that, believing that Jesus is, quote, making himself equal to God. And what is it that the Jews are ultimately believing? What is it that they're claiming about what Jesus is saying? And ultimately, what is Jesus saying? And then once we get clear about what Jesus is saying there and what the response is of the Jews, it's going to make the rest of chapter 5 make a whole lot more sense. Okay, there's a lot that Jesus will say about himself in chapter 5, and it all comes back to understanding what the charge of the Jews is against Jesus here. He's making himself equal to God. Okay, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. Let's talk about the story. All right, so John chapter 5, verse 1, after these things, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem, as all good Jews would. If you were living in the Galilee, there was those three required feasts that everyone that Torah called all good covenant-keeping Jews to attend in Jerusalem. This is likely one of those, and Jesus has gone up. And now we get this sort of like bit of topography and geography of a place in Jerusalem called the Sheep Pool, right? Now, there was in Jerusalem by the Sheep Pool, which in Hebrew is called Bethesda, having five porticos. Okay, so this is just this place, which they're pretty sure they've located it. It's just north of the temple and the temple plaza. And basically, it's this place, this natural spring and this pool that got built and created there. Five porticos. A portico is essentially like a roofed area, maybe held up by pillars. And so, like, clearly there's a place for people to be out of the sun, hanging out here by the pool. And what John tells us is that by these pools, there's two there. They believe there was originally two, maybe divided by a small wall, maybe not. But in these porticos, laying out of the sun, was a multitude of those who were sick, blind, lame, and withered. Now, why are these people here? Right? Why are all these sick folks and lame and blind folks hanging out by this pool? Okay, at this point, there is a textual variant that you will see. And this is the sort of the narration for an explanation for why these people are here. Waiting for the moving of the waters, for an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the water, and whoever then first after the stirring up of the water stepped in was made well from whatever disease which he or she was afflicted with. Now, all of our earliest manuscripts do not contain that. This is very highly likely an addition into the text of John's gospel. Now, why is it there? Well, there could be potentially a couple of different reasons. Notice that down when the man is asked by Jesus, "Do you want to get well?" his response is, "Well, I have no one to get me into the pool when the water is stirred and someone gets down there before I do." So it's possible that whoever sort of got a hold of and has put this addition into some later manuscript, there is clearly a need on some level for the man's statement to Jesus to make some sort of sense. Because without what we have at the end of verse 3 and verse 4, the man's statement is maybe not quite as understood as it could be. And so it could potentially be that someone has added this in order for us to make better sense of what the man says when he's asked by Jesus, "Do you want to get well?" There's also some local legends about this particular pool. Hadrian had turned these waters into, and this area into, kind of a shrine for one of the Roman, I think it was a goddess, Serapis. And it was believed that these waters potentially had therapeutic power. And so how early that legend and this connection to the waters having therapeutic powers and when Hadrian did what he did, etc., it's not exactly clear exactly when that was cemented as yep, this is a place where you go. But clearly there's a lot of people here who are hanging out by this pool that are sick. So something has brought them here. Whether or not there is literally an angel of Yahweh who comes down at various seasons and stirs the water, and actually it is the case that whoever touches the pool first gets healed, that seems sort of a little far-fetched, right? This is not exactly how the God of Israel usually chooses to work. Let's see who the lucky person is today who can push other people aside and get down to the water first, right? This is not exactly how Yahweh is sort of in the business of doing things. But be that as it may, this is what the man believes, right? He believes that there's something very important about why he has not been healed yet, and it's because he doesn't have a man to get him to the water. Okay, so end part of 3, verse 4, not original to John's text, I believe. And so what we have is at the end, so it reads in this way: in these porticos lay a multitude of those who were sick, blind, lame, and withered, and a certain man was there who had been 38 years in his sickness. Okay, that's a lot of years. So typically what my mind does is my mind imagines a really crusty old dude who is laying on this very crusty old mat, who has literally been hanging out by this pool for 38 years. And the text doesn't actually say that. The text just says he's been sick for 38 years. Okay. Now, how long has he been like hanging out by the waters? Well, long enough that he feels like he knows the drill and he keeps seeing other people get to the water before him. And so this is a thing. Has he been there 38 years? We don't know. But he's been sick for 38 years. And whatever his sickness is, it apparently keeps him fairly immobile. He's got a mat and he is not himself able to amble down to the water without help. Okay, so this is what we know. All right, now verse 6, when Jesus sees him lying there, or saw him lying there, and Jesus knew that he had already been a long time, and the NASB text says, in that condition. And I think that's right. I think it's not that Jesus knew that he had been laying here in this portico by this pool for a long time. It's that Jesus knew that he had been sick for a long time. He says to him, so when he sees the man, knew he had been long in his sickness, he says to him, do you wish to get well? Which is an interesting question. I mean, I think there's some psychology going on here that we don't have time necessarily to unpack all of. But I'm trying to imagine, you know that this man has been sick for a long time. And clearly this man's life revolves around and is focused, at least for a time anyway. You've got your friends to haul you over to this pool day after day, week after week, who knows how long. He's been there. He's wanting to, there's a reason he's there, right? I'm assuming he has come to like just hang out. I mean, maybe, but clearly the man's life has been impacted by his sickness. And he's been a long time in his sickness. And here Jesus is saying, do you want to get well? Now, we're going to come back to this as it pertains to potentially us. But the sick man, notice the sick man's response. Yes, I want to get well. That's not what he says. Notice that he doesn't answer the question exactly. Instead, he says, the sick man says, sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. While I'm coming down, another steps down before me. So in essence, Jesus has said, do you want to get well? And the man has basically said to Jesus, here's the reason why I'm not well already. Right? Now, I want to be charitable to this guy. It is potentially possible that the Greek, there's some flexibility here. It could be that the verb to be made well is passive. It's either middle or passive. And it's possible that the language is, do you wish to be made well? Not the middle, but do you want to become well? But do you wish to be made well? So it is possible if the man hears the language, do I wish to be made well? Well, his answer makes sense on some level to that, which is, well, there's one way for me to be made well. That is, I need a man. I need a person to get me into that pool. And I don't have that person, right? But I don't know. That might be like hinging too much on the voice of the verb. It's most likely, probably most straightforwardly, just Jesus saying, do you want to become well? And again, the answer to the question is not, yes, I want to become well. It is, well, there's a reason I'm already not well. There's a reason I'm here, right? And we'll come back to that. Verse 8. Jesus said to him, arise, take up your mat or your pallet and walk. And immediately the man became well and took up his pallet and began to walk. Okay, notice a couple things. Do you want to be made well? I have a problem. Jesus takes care of the problem. You don't need a man to take you down to that pool. Jesus' speech causes the man to be healed. Arise, take up your pallet and walk. and the man becomes well. And he takes up his pallet and he walks. Okay, that's really cool. Here's this miracle that Jesus does. This man has no one to get him to the pool. Jesus comes along. He doesn't need to take him to the pool. He speaks to him and the man is healed. And that's a big deal. That's a big deal. Now, my mind naturally is asking just naturally sort of compares. Okay, here's this third sign. And here's this man who doesn't necessarily appear to be interested in Jesus, know Jesus. We're not sure. The text doesn't say whether or not the man believes Jesus. He just does what he's told. And maybe there is something there inherently in that. Like, okay, you told me to get up. I'm going to get up and whoa, I'm healed. So maybe there's faith there. But it's different, notice, than the royal official who Jesus required that man to believe his word, to go back to his son without Jesus. He required faith on the part of that man, right? And then, of course, there was the first sign in which the disciples had already come to believe potentially that Jesus was the Messiah based on the testimony of John the Baptist. And the sign that Jesus gives confirms that belief that they had already had. Here, we don't have anything like that. There's no statement by John, as we have in sign one and sign two, that the man sees and he believes, or the man, you know, walks and he believes. Instead, we have something different. We have something different. Let's notice. Now, it was the Sabbath on that day, and therefore the Jews were saying to him who was cured, "It is the Sabbath, and it is not permissible for you to carry your pallet." But the man answered them, "Well, he who made me well was the one who said to me, 'Take up your pallet and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your pallet and walk?'" But he who is healed did not know who it was. Right? There's no knowledge of who Jesus is at this point. And when confronted by the authorities, the response is, "Well, it was my healer," right? "My healer is the one who told me to do this." "Well, who's the guy who healed you?" "I don't know." "But he who was healed did not know, for Jesus had slipped away while there was a crowd in that place." Now, Jesus is going to make sure this man knows. Afterward, verse 14, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "Behold, you have become well." Remember that question I asked you? Do you want to become well? "You've become well," right? "Do not sin anymore so that nothing worse may befall you." Now, we'll come back to what that might mean in a second. But notice this. As soon as the man finds out who his healer was, what is his response? "I'm going to worship you. I'm going to believe in you. I'm going to follow you." Oh, no, no, no. He goes back and he tells the Jews, "That's the guy who healed me. He's the guy you should be persecuting." Right? Right? "It's not my fault that I was carrying my pallet. Don't get mad at me. It was that dude. It was Jesus." Right? That's what he does. He goes and he tells the Jews, "It was Jesus." Right? And for this reason, the Jews begin to persecute Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. So here we have a story where Jesus heals a man. The man essentially has no belief in the one who's healed him. And in fact, he wants to throw Jesus sort of under the bus, right? Because, like, he doesn't want the Jews to be mad at him. Which kind of fits. Do you want to get well? Well, no one... Like, what did the man, what was the man's response again? Like, "It's other people's fault that I'm not well," right? "Well, I'm carrying my mat because of Jesus." This dude, like, so clearly, this man is just like Ben. I mean me. I mean, clearly, like, here's the deal. Like, this is us, right? Like, this is definitely me. Don't get mad at me. So, sorry, Ben. So this is a very, like, this is interesting. This is very interesting. Once we start to sort of, like, see this unpacked and see what this man's response is and see how different this response is from this man who was physically benefited by Jesus with this miracle, how different that response was from the royal official and obviously from the disciples who witnessed the water turned into wine. There's no interest, apparently, on this man's part to see and hear, right? To know, okay? And in some ways, it's interesting, like, well, why has John recorded this? Like, he chose from all of these things, and he chose this ungrateful man to talk about. But the reality is that this fits with what John is attempting to reveal about the truth in terms of how people interacted with Jesus. And it actually is in some ways very symbolic. This man of Jerusalem healed by Jesus is in his own personal response on some level feels highly symbolic for the response that Jerusalem as a whole is going to offer Jesus throughout the context of the gospel and ultimately in the way in which they will reject and kill him. That some people see and some people don't see. And in this situation, when the man is healed, there is no rejoicing on the man's part. There's no gratitude on the man's part. And you notice that the rulers, the Jews, all they can see is that here's a man breaking the Sabbath. What are you doing? I mean, you would think, hey, see a man carrying a pallet. Why are you carrying this pallet? It's a Sabbath. Well, I was healed. Can you believe that? Oh my gosh, that's so amazing. That's great. Okay, stop carrying the pallet, but we're happy for you. But there's none of this, right? There's none of this. All it is a fixation on this really, really, really powerful part of Jewish society, which is Sabbath keeping. And there's lots to say there about that. But the thing is it's very interesting to just sort of be able to compare this story to what's gone on already. And to see and notice in the response here of the man and ultimately in the rulers and the Pharisees here, there's something very highly sort of symbolic about it. Okay. Now, the Sabbath is important. The Sabbath was one of those key markers in what designated a member of the covenant community. It wasn't just a throwaway day, a religious thing for fanatics. There were some very important pieces of legislation that God gave to his people that they would be marked as his covenant people. One of those, of course, was circumcision. The circumcision was what we call a boundary marker, demarcating who was in the covenant community and who was not a part of the covenant community. Another boundary marker was, of course, eating, the way in which a Jew was to eat, kosher. And the third primary boundary marker was, are you a Sabbath keeper? Those three things in particular, because of the outward nature of them, marked a Jew as someone who cared about the things of Yahweh or didn't. So it's not like, oh, here's these people who are like just trying to be super religious. And no, this was important. You know, this was part of God's covenant with his people. Now, the question around, well, did Jesus actually break the Sabbath? Did he not actually break the Sabbath by what he did. Because notice there were two parts to the breaking of the Sabbath. One, he healed the man, right? And that was problematic from the perspective of the religious rulers, the Jews. And by the way, whenever I'm using these terms interchangeably, John is interesting in his gospel. He's often referring to the people in power, Pharisees, the rulers. He's often referring to the people in power as just the Jews. Okay? And so when there are times where he uses the term the Jews to mean the multitudes of people that are maybe in the temple or in Jerusalem, that sort of thing. But oftentimes when he's referring to the Jews, he's referring specifically to those who were the rulers of the Jews, the Pharisees, those who were kind of overseeing and shepherding the people. And remember, like, everyone was a Jew there, right? Or most people. I mean, there was Romans there and some others, but by and large, like, all the people were Jews. But here, when John says the man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well, John's referring to specifically the rulers of the Jews, the Pharisees, the power brokers in Jerusalem. So the big question is, then, here we are in verse 16 and 17. The Jews find out that it was Jesus who healed the man on the Sabbath. It was Jesus who told the man to pick up his pallet and walk. And for this reason, they were persecuting him. Now, Jesus' response in verse 17, we'll get to that in a moment. We have to know that, like, probably it is likely the case that it wasn't just because Jesus happened to heal the man or happened to tell him to pick up his pallet and walk that was, like, that was problematic for them. That was absolutely problematic. But we have to know that on some level, it is more problematic because the Jews, that is the rulers, know that this man has made basically overtures to being the Messiah. That this man has basically said he has authority over the temple, and this man is the one who is causing people to believe in his name. And so it is more highly problematic that Jesus is who he is and having done what he's done and having said what he said already than that simply there was this, like, potential work on the Sabbath. There was not a... I mean, we could talk more about that, but just putting that out there. So, Jesus' response to them, verse 17, he answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I myself am working." Okay, before we unpack that, I just want to sort of take a stand back now and just have you notice that what is likely happened here is that Jesus, from the very get-go, has orchestrated a moment so that he could essentially reveal more about himself to the Jews, to the people in Jerusalem. Jesus specifically went to this pool where he knew who was hanging out, the sick, the lame, the withered. He found someone who had been there a long time, and notice that he chose someone that had a mat, right? Because Jesus didn't have to choose. I mean, like, he went and he found the pool. He went and he's like, found the man. Yes, you'll do nicely. Because why? Right? This man doesn't give a shit about Jesus. He doesn't. But this man is being used ultimately for the glory of God, because this man is being used for Jesus to forward a very important thing that he wants to say about himself. Pick up your mat. I want people to see this. I want people to ask the question. I think it's important that we understand that. And I think that makes more sense of ultimately recognizing that, you know, in so many other, especially the synoptic gospels, there's often this dynamic where we find that Jesus is marveling at people's faith, and he's doing miracles for people who believe. And there's the comment that he's in his hometown, and he was marveling that he could do not very many miracles because of their lack of belief. But that doesn't seem to bother him here. That is not the point here. The point is not to ultimately engender faith and belief in this man, although I think Jesus does want that. And he goes after the man and he tells him, sin no more, right? I think he cares about the man. But at the end of the day, the reason that this has all happened is so that Jesus can ultimately have the conversation that we're going to unpack more next time. We'll begin it now. But I think that's important for us to note that Jesus went looking to pick a fight, like Mel Gibson in Braveheart, right? And how does Jesus pick the fight? Verse 17. This is what I've been waiting for, because I went, I found this man. He doesn't care about me. I healed him. I told him to carry his pallet. It was the Sabbath. He didn't know who it was, so I went and found him and said, this is me, so that he'd go back, he'd tell the Jews, so that I could say what I'm about to say. My Father is working until now, and I myself am working. Okay, I want you to stop for a moment and think about that. My Father is working until now, and I myself am working. Well, first of all, it's the Sabbath. So there's a tension there, right? Because as we know, the Sabbath was instituted to commemorate the day in which God did what? God rested, right? God rested on the Sabbath. And so, wait a second, my Father is working until now? Like, okay, that's interesting. And then secondly, notice that Jesus is sort of like, he calls God his Father, and he basically says, essentially, because God is working, I'm working. That's a big statement, all right? Now, what does it mean? What does Jesus mean when he says, my Father is working until now? Well, it is clear, and it was clear to the rabbis, that once God had brought together creation, created creation, that it wasn't just that he was like letting it kind of spin out. There wasn't like, okay, I'm done. Like now I'm just kind of resting on my laurels. But there was an understanding that God was sovereignly always at work. And so even though there was this Sabbath where on the first Sabbath, God himself rested, it was understood that the Sabbath was for man. And that ultimately God himself was continuing to rule, continuing to sovereignly guide and manage. And how was that sovereign guidance and management embodied? Well, in so many ways, of course, it was embodied in the creation continuing to go as creation needed to go, but also because people died on the Sabbath and people were born on the Sabbath, that God was understood to be at work. And the rabbis, there's lots of discussion about this. And so here, when Jesus says, my Father is working until now and I myself am working, well, Jesus is essentially, and what he's going to go on and tell us is, that he has been given two specific prerogatives that Yahweh himself is understood and was always understood to personally hold as God of the universe, the prerogative to give life and the prerogative to judge. And that is what he's going to go on and tell the Jews that he has been given as the Son, the prerogative to give life and the prerogative to judge. Both things that happen all the time on the Sabbath. People die and are judged. People are born, that God is working even on the Sabbath. And just as ultimately Jesus is making a man whole on the Sabbath, Jesus is saying, I'm doing exactly what my Father is always and continues to do on the Sabbath. Okay. Now that's pretty incendiary stuff for the Jews. And so they say, you know, John says, Therefore, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him because he not only was breaking the Sabbath, okay, so they wanted to kill him for that, probably because he was also making himself out as Messiah. And they want to kill him for that, but now all the more they want to kill him because he was calling God his own father, making himself equal with God. Okay, now, can't say everything right now, so I'm going to just put this teaser out for next time, and then I want to go back and say one other thing, and the teaser is this. What Jesus will end up saying, beginning in verse 19, down through the end of verse 47, the rest of chapter 5, is in response to defending against the charge that he is, quote, making himself equal with God. He is not responding to the charge that he is equal with God. He is responding to the charge that he is making himself that. And that is why he will go on to say the Son can do nothing that the Father isn't doing. The things that he sees the Father doing, he does in like manner. And he'll go on to explain more and more of that. But it is specifically the charge that Jesus is taking the glory to himself. It is not that he is defending against the charge that he's equal with the Father, because I think Jesus is ultimately going to say, no, I'm kind of equal with the Father. But it is the charge that he is making that case for himself, that he is bringing that honor to himself. And that's what we'll explain and we'll explore a little bit more, a lot more, as we look at the rest of chapter 5 next time. But I want to go back and I want to say this to us. If you go back to Jesus' question to wrap up to the man, I was thinking about that question. Do you wish to get well? And I think, you know, ultimately, all of us, we may not have a mat. We may not be such that we cannot do things for ourselves, but all of us have been a long time in our sickness. And all of us struggle to let go of some of our sickness. And some of our sickness comes because of trauma, stuff that has been done to us. And we have trauma response and we have struggle in our lives because we just can't overcome the things that God has somehow allowed. But Jesus has come along and he's asking each of us, do you wish to get well? And ultimately, the answer has to be yes, if we are going to be people who truly embrace Jesus as the Messiah. Because Jesus is going to make well all of us. All of us who come to believe in him as the Messiah will be made well on the other side of the grave. We don't get to be made well in that true way that we long for without going through the dying, without going through the process of having to live with the struggle. And if we are saying yes to this God who is asking us, do we wish to get well? We are having to acknowledge that most of us are not going to overcome in this world, in this life, all the things that cause us struggle. We're going to see better. We're going to grow in wisdom. Hopefully, we're going to have habits change over time. But ultimately, we have to trust in a God who is offering us wholeness on the other side of death. And that's not easy. So it does for us to take very clear eyes to see and ears to hear, to be willing to accept the Messiah offering us wholeness and health, offering us wholeness and health on the other side of death. but as he will end up telling the Jews in Jerusalem and ultimately doing for Lazarus, he's in control of who gets to be raised. So we trust him.
A few minutes for questions. Anyone have any questions this morning?
Thanks, Ryan. I don't know if this is opening a can of worms, but verse 14. Later, Jesus found him at the temple, said to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse might happen to you." So in that, is it his prior ailment was because of sin, or is it another general statement?
I forgot to come back. Yeah, that's a great question. On the surface, that is sort of kind of is the assumption, like what you pointed out, like that without critically thinking about it too much, it would appear as though Jesus suggested that the reason he was sick for 3 years was because of sin. Now, while it is true that in the ancient Near East, it was believed oftentimes that sin was connected to bodily illness, right? You notice in John chapter 9 when Jesus heals the man born blind, the question that gets posed is, was this guy the person who sinned, or was it his parents who sinned since he was born blind? So there is this ubiquitous sort of sense that illness and sickness was connected to sin. Now, is that what Jesus is doing here? Is that what he's saying? I don't know. There is a possibility that he could be actually, an option B could be that Jesus knows that this man has not actually responded in faith to Jesus, right? And so that stop sinning could be a way for Jesus to say, ultimately, look, you're going to have to get on board with who I am and ultimately, like, respond to me as I ultimately need to be responded to, or else something worse may befall. Well, Jesus is going to go on to talk about what he has the power over. That is the power over life and judgment, right? So what is the worst thing that's going to befall him? Well, ultimately, the worst thing is that he's going to fall under the judgment of the Son because he doesn't believe. And so is the sin that Jesus is specifically talking about, more specifically, everything that you've done up to this point has shown that you regard nothing for who I am and what I've done for you. And so that's it. That's another option. Any more thoughts on that? Because it's a great question. Okay.
Any other questions? Doug.
Yeah, Ryan, the part where you talked a little bit about the man's response or lack of response and said, then he ran off and threw Jesus under the bus.
Mm-hmm.
I think you were using humor there as a device, because I think your real point was it's not about the man's response in this case, right? That Jesus, for lack of better terminology, had an agenda.
Yeah.
It feels to me, if I'm reading between your humor, that really John almost omits the response, right? He tells the man to stand up and take your pallet. The man does it. He doesn't say thank you. He doesn't. There's no communication. So am I understanding really what you were trying to say there, that it's not so much about them, or that there is no real response? I mean, the Jews approach him. He says, "Oh, this guy." And then Jesus says, to your comment, right, I want you to know it was me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the man, it doesn't, to me, I don't interpret it like he ran off and be like, "Oh, it was Jesus, that guy." I don't interpret it that way, because it's more that Jesus had that objective that he was trying to achieve. So am I reading between the lines there a little bit? I mean, were you using humor, or do you really feel like maybe the man was throwing him under the bus? I guess that's where my brain got stuck during your talk. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, my wife would say that it's never fully just humor. it's you're not all joking, Ryan. I think it's both. I think that there's a level at which Yes, there's an agenda that Jesus has. John is focused on being able to see that agenda, like to like show us the reader, like Jesus wanted to heal this guy on the Sabbath to set up this confrontation. That's like for sure, right? And then in terms of the man's response, yeah, I mean, that is up for interpretation and debate. It's just interesting that what we see is, and especially like notice what we see between this man and the man born blind, because the man born blind was also healed on the Sabbath. And when the Jews come to him and are like, who is your healer? He doesn't back down. He tells them exactly who he thinks Jesus is. He's a prophet, and I believe in him, and why don't you guys believe in him? And here, you just have a man who at least on some level feels like all he's trying to do is just like make his way through the world and like not have anyone be upset with him. And so to that end, you know, when they accuse him of Sabbath breaking, all he can say is, well, wait a sec, no, like the guy who healed me, you know. And so I don't know, Doug. I think that, you know, it could go either way. But I do think that it's interesting that the testimony, we've been so used to the testimony that leads to faith and belief. And here in this story, the testimony of the man, when he goes and he tells the Jews it was Jesus who made him well, that this leads to persecution, right? And so there's this real difference in response. And whether the man himself has gratitude, John chooses to not incorporate that. And maybe that's an argument from silence, and maybe he was, but John's really trying to sort of focus on this. Anyway.
I guess that's where I was kind of going a little bit. Like, it would be surprising to me that somebody who was healed wouldn't be like, well, cool, thanks. You know, like some sort of response there. Or when Jesus came and identified himself, some sort, there's no dialogue, right, between the two of them. It's a mm-hmm. one-way communication. That's all. It's just an interesting yeah. thing. On the man born blind, do they have a, I don't remember. Is there any communication between Jesus and?
At the very end, after, so Jesus heals him by sending him away first. He's like, you've been born blind. Go to this pool over here, different pool than the sheep pool. Go to the pool of Siloam. Clean off the mud that I put in your eyes. And so he does that. The man then has a whole exchange with the Jews before Jesus comes back at the very end and engages with the man. And so, you know, Jesus says, do you believe in the Son of Man? And Jesus says, and the man born blind says, well, who is he that I may believe? And Jesus' response is, you are seeing him. And the man in front of you, right? And so anyway, and then it says the man worshipped him. Yeah. Yeah.
I think to your point, I think John, it feels like, is trying to differentiate these stories. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, by really excluding any sort of dialogue there between Jesus and the man.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, the objective was to get the Jewish leaders to come and kind of confront him.
Yeah. The objective is to pick a fight here. So. Yeah, and ultimately he's going to say some pretty incendiary things. Like, yeah, it's going to be fun. 2 weeks from now. Okay, anything else? Debbie's at it. Okay.
Just a comment, not really a question. Well, maybe it's a question. It seems like, and gosh, maybe you even said this and I missed it, but it seems like when Jesus heals somebody, he usually says, don't tell anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And here he doesn't say that, and in fact he goes and finds him and says, you know, oh, you know, you're better. So just that, like, yeah, this is a different agenda, like,
right, kind of, yeah, you know. Yeah, pick up that mat so people might see you, and oh, by the way, my name is Jesus. Yeah. go tell him Jesus sent you. Yeah, no, that's yeah. Have a great day, guys.